When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What part of the story becomes this competition between the R100 and the R101? And it is interesting. Thompson should never have done that. He split. I mean, there were the surviving. There was a terrible British air crash in 1921 where basically most of the airship establishment had gone down with it. So there were very few people
which
with
that. Should have been a clue, really, shouldn't it?
Should have been a clue, yeah.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bowen. The R101 is one of those, I'm going to say it, great imperial follies. Don't at me for that one. There's been enough about it already. I'm not a fan of the R101 tale, but that's going to make up our entire episode this week, as we're joined by the fabulous S.C. Gwynne, whose new book, His Majesty's Airship, is all about the men behind the creation of one of the largest air vessels ever completed, built, the whole shebang, here in the UK, just outside Bedford at Cardington. Now, Sam is an author who I've been really looking forward to talking to, because this other book of his, which is called Empire of the Summer Moon, all about Quanah Parker, is one that I've lent to people before I've had a chance to read and never gotten back. So the one I'm waving around, if you're watching this on YouTube, is the third time I've bought it. So I'm going to get stuck into that as well. And that's where we have to start, because before we get into His Majesty's Airship, I have to ask him what led him to make the leap from his usual haunts of the United States in the 19th century to come over here to Britain and a massive bag filled with hydrogen. Like I said, Empire of the Summer Moon has been on my reading list for ages. And I guess a lot that sort of framed a lot of your work being 19th century Americana, I suppose. How does someone who's spent a lot of their career with quite well reputes with your work as well, how do you come to write about an airship in mid-century Britain? Because that seems a bit of a leap. Or was it intentional to do something that different after a few books in?
I think based on my book about the Comanches and then a biography of Stonewall Jackson and another book about the Civil War. I mean, I think people think of me as being planted firmly in the 19th century somewhere. I never really saw myself that way. I mean, in most of my career, I've been a journalist, and journalists have short attention spans, generally speaking. And, you know, you do your story and it's on the bottom of someone's birdcage by Monday night or whenever, and then you move on to the next story and what kind of makes you happy are good stories, and you're looking for good stories and you're never on one very long. But anyway, so journalists, yes, have the attention span of a gnat. So for me, I have been trying to really just find the very best stories that I can find. And typically I want them to be, certainly set in history and almost always beyond human memory. but also to be about some sort of a great tale, but also set in some larger kind of scene, something with larger meaning. And so I was reading. Okay, this is a long-winded way of answering your question, but
go for it.
So I was reading a three-volume history of the British Empire, a magnificent history by a writer named James Morris, who became later Jan Morris, mm-hmm. a British historian. Just magnificent. It knocks me down. It's so good. It's called The Pax Britannica is the trilogy. And the third volume is Farewell to Trumpets. And it's about how kind of the British Empire is starting to get a little creaky and, you know, and eventually declines. And so the book is about traces the empire from its apogee in Victorian times to what happened in the 20th century. And inside of this book, there was a little two-page section on this airship that was somehow all wound up in all these imperial ambitions and all this kind of sense of Britain coming out of World War I as the largest empire in the history of the world. And what was it going to do with the empire? And this crash that was much more interesting than the Hindenburg. And I thought, this is a great story. And so it's a great tale. The Hindenburg really isn't that great a tale. It's just like what made the thing go boom. R101, as you have seen, is a fascinating tale that spans years and all sorts of great characters. And so I was just able to, I just thought that this is great. It's a book about empire. It's a great book about a crash that was, you know, more lethal again than the Hindenburg. But the third thing I guess that it had, from my point of view, was that nobody knew about it. Somehow history had overwritten R101 for whatever reason. There's no reason it should have. It overwrote Herbert Scott, the guy, the great airship pilot who did the first east-west crossing of the Atlantic. Anyway, I'm going on and on and on. But that's a really long-winded answer to your question.
Oh, fabulous long-winded answer. Thank you.
Okay. You may have some more on the way.
As a Canadian who's lived here for more than he's ever lived in Canada, I've learned that the British are very good at moving on from disasters, or they make a great thing about it. Yeah, they give somebody a whole bunch of VCs and they forget about the thing that happened a little bit earlier. And dear listener, if you have not read any of Jan Morris's work, do check it out, because Jan
brilliant.
Wasn't she the only reporter that was with the Hillary Norden expedition to Everest as well? Fantastic life.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a lot of books and a lot of a wide scope of endeavor and types of histories and everything. But this, I say, Pax Britannica, if you want to read a one volume history, three volume history of the British Empire, this is as good as I can imagine.
Right. Let's get on. Before we get on track, I'm just going to say, if anyone has my copy of Empire of the Summer Moon, give it back, because I still need to read it, which is Sam's book about Quanah Parker. Do it. Right. So let's start simple here. We've done the what brought you into it, but we have to be clear about this. What is an airship? Because we're going to be talking about a couple of them in the course of our chat. It's not a blimp, is it? It's as we would recognize flying over sporting events and things like that. An airship is a specific type of craft, isn't it?
Yes, and it really is. I'm glad you asked that question first, because we have to define terms here. And in fact, what we're talking about here is a rigid airship. Mm-hmm. Rigid is the key. Actually, an airship can almost define anything that can go up and has a rudder and a propeller and is lighter than air and can fly around. But a rigid airship, but we'll get to it in a second. Okay, so the 18th century, they invented balloons. And balloons were these remarkable things. I mean, they were lighter than air and they went up in a world where, as you and I know, everything else goes down. These things went up. Kind of amazing. Wow, it goes up. And the problem with if you put hydrogen or hot air in a balloon, it would kind of go wherever the wind or God wanted it to go. And they were great as military observation, you know, vehicles, but they weren't very good for much else, because they would just go where they want. Anyway, in the 19th century, the French improved this by basically putting a propeller and an engine and a rudder onto a balloon. And this became kind of the first airship, because it was steerable. And the word in French for to be able to steer or direct is diriger. And something that you could direct became a dirigeable, you know, dirigible. And but the problem with balloons, which were just really, it's just an envelope that you filled up, you know, like a balloon with gas of some kind, and it went up, was that they tended to collapse on themselves, and they really didn't, you know, they couldn't lift much was the problem. I mean, the thing that collapsed on itself easy once you got to a certain size, and I mean, you know, like 120 feet or 150 feet, that was about it. So you could only lift as much as the, you know, gas that you could put in the balloon. And so in 1900, this this brilliant German entrepreneur named Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin, with a magnificent walrus mustache, invented the rigid airship. And what the rigid airship was, it had a skeleton. It had a steel skeleton. And inside the skeleton were hydrogen-filled gas bags. And because these things, because von Zeppelin's first ship, I think, was 430 feet long, these enormous things, you could put so many hydrogen gas bags in it, you could lift a lot. And this was the absolutely groundbreaking, you know, piece of technology in the Zeppelin. So starting in 1900, you have the advent of the rigid airship. They were all big. They got eventually to more than 800 feet long, the German airships of the 30s, like the Hindenburg. And just, and you know, again, they, because of that, they could lift a lot of whatever it was you wanted to lift, you know, people, cargo, or in the case of the Germans, bombs. I think that answers your question. Anyway, but that, oh, and I should say that if we look at the blimps that fly, like the Fuji blimp or the Goodyear blimp or whatever the blimps that may be, those are really, they're not rigid. They don't have a steel structure. They may have a keel that's rigid, but they're really just, it's a balloon, an envelope filled up with, in this case, helium, that allows them to be lighter than air and float. But they're not one of the things. If you look at one of the blimps that flies over Wembley or flies over whatever they're flying over in America, football games, baseball games, and so forth, they're not that big. That's because they're constrained by the fact that they don't have the rigid skeleton. So when you think of when people think of the, you know, the most famous airship, the one everybody knows about, Hindenburg, that is a giant, that is exactly what a rigid airship is. It's a giant steel structure filled with hydrogen.
And they enter the public consciousness because they're just the most amazing things, because they're the almost the main character in H.G. Wells's War in the Air as well, aren't they? They're the thing that terrorizes.
It's a terror weapon. Britain.
Yeah. And then, remarkably, as Wells tended to get things right, that's exactly what happened in the First World War. These things started trundling over, and they capture imagination in a way that probably outsizes their actual usefulness, doesn't it?
That is a really good observation, because the question just persists with airships is why they were kind of a bad idea and why did they persist so long? But there was something about them, you know, that they were these large things. And as you said, so when von Zeppelin invented them, he didn't intend for them to be a passenger airships or cargo airships. I mean, he had one and only one use for them, and that was as weapons. And that was all he wanted to do. And he was very much in step with the times in Germany as we approached World War One. In fact, there was I quote in my book, a song that German school children were singing in 1913, I think. And it was "Fly, Zeppelin, fly, you know, fly to England. England shall be destroyed by fire." You know, cute little German kids. Anyway, point being that there was a martial sentiment in Germany at that time. And so Zeppelins, people forget about this. People think of, you know, London being bombed by the Luftwaffe in World War II and everything. But the first long-range bombers, the first weapons of mass terror were Zeppelins, unleashed by Germany against seven European cities, mostly against England. They were entirely designed to be weapons. They were weapons. They didn't work very well as weapons, but that really changed the world. And it introduced it in a lot of ways, or actually outright, it introduced humankind to the notion that it could be annihilated from above by something other than a thunderbolt. Now, first time that had ever happened. And as you said, just the size of them, when some 680-foot German Zeppelin came droning over London at 2 a.m., I mean, this was, you know, this was just absolutely nothing that anybody had even imagined before.
Big, noisy, and slow.
Yes.
That's always my takeaway from those stories.
Yes. Yeah.
And as we, as yeah, everybody knows about airships, they're designed to be these weapons of war, but they're filled with massive amounts of highly explosive gas.
Yeah, so you here's what you have to add to your configuration: big, noisy, and slow, and which is great if you're a British fighter plane. Oh, but we add the fourth thing, which is, oh yes, and they're filled with hydrogen. It's like let's play video games. One incendiary bullet from a British fighter in 1916-17. I mean, we just imagine the Hindenburg. That's what it does. Quite satisfying if you're the fighter pilot.
Yeah, and that's another podcast. Yeah, the strange VCs that are awarded for shooting down Zeppelins. It's
yes.
They're fantastic. Anyways, let's start getting into our sort of characters here, because they leave this, like we were saying, oversized memory, isn't it? Because there's an expectation of these things being these incredible marvels of German engineering. But what you do in the book so well is talk about how rushed the Zeppelins actually are. They get progressively less engineered as they go along, don't they? But the British have this idea of, as we all do, a German engineered marvel, and they exit the war thinking that this is the way forward, isn't it?
It is, in spite of the fact that so many of the German Zeppelins went down. I mean, they went down incendiary bullets from fighter planes. They crashed they burned in their sheds. They crashed into the channel. They were blown to God knows where. I mean, they were very difficult to navigate. They were easy to shoot down, and they were lousy as weapons, but still, in World War I, Britain saw them as technology that they couldn't get. And they tried very, very hard to get it. They tried to emulate the Germans, but the Germans had a good lead. I mean, a really good lead on them. And so when the British built an airship, what they do is they go find a downed Zeppelin, and they'd crawl all over it with the engineers, and they would sort of figure out, do the best they could to figure out how it worked. And then they would engineer it up. But by the time they put that airship into the air, they were several years behind the Germans. And the Germans, if that airship could fly at 10,000 feet, 2 years later, by the time the British had it, the Germans could fly at 20,000 feet or had bigger engines and more lift. And so Britain spent all of World War I trying to catch up and never got an operational. They intended to use them mostly as scouts, but they never really got an operational airship, rigid airship. Coming out of the war, of course, Germany, which was by far the leader, I mean, no one was even close, was forbidden now from building any of these things, certainly not for weapons, but they had difficulty building any of them because of the Versailles Treaty. And so you have this moment where the Brits say, okay, here we go. You know, we've got this clear field to play on. We're going to put British technology, we're going to improve and perfect these German Zeppelins. And this is what happened in the 1920s. And the hero of the hero airship of my book, R101, is the sort of final product of the British attempt to do the Germans one better, to kind of perfect this idea that was flawed. The problem was that there were flaws that no matter how much technology the British put into it, it didn't solve the underlying flaws, I should say. Which were not, now hydrogen was just one of them. There were many, many flaws. Hydrogen was just one of them.
Note to listeners, we're big fans of hydrogen on the show, but for different uses than airships.
For different uses, yeah. I'm reading about hydrogen these days. It may save the planet. It may save everything. But in this particular application, no.
Let's get on to Christopher Thomas, because he is a remarkably British character. It's the only way I can come to describe him, isn't he? He's quintessential product of empire.
Of empire.
Yeah. Why did he have this belief in what we'll go on to talk about is the Imperial Airship Scheme? Why was he so driven? Because it seems, in researching around him outside your book, he's inseparable from this idea of the airship as crown and glory of empire.
He is. He's the central character in the book. He's the hero of the book. He is a product of five generations of military mostly generals, but very influential people in the Raj. He all of his family on both sides, enormously influential, grew up in India. I mean, going back to the 18th century. And so he grows up there. He eventually moves to England. He then participates in many, many military campaigns, which include the Boer War, include Palestine. I mean, he was with Kitchener. I mean, he fought in all of these theaters of empire. And so we have this guy who, even though very quite interestingly, he's a socialist. He joined the first Labour government, Ramsay MacDonald's government, but he was still very, very much a man of empire, and which is appropriate because he was the man who had the vision that drove essentially R101 into the ground eventually. But the original vision was to populate the skies of the world, which was largely a British world, with British airships using British technology, a kind of a restoration in some ways to, when you think of the British Empire in the 19th century, you think of the pounding piston, the grease piston, and just the technological ability. They could build guns and they could build machines and locomotives and boats. I mean, better than anybody else. And empire power rested on this. And to some extent, the vision that Christopher Birdwood Thompson had was to, in a sense, restore the kind of British technological supremacy in the air, in this case through airships. So it was a grand vision. As you say, we can get to the imperial airship scheme whenever you like.
Because his life is just, how you described it as well. And he's got the sort of, there's a love interest in the tale as well, who probably deserves her own biography as well. Who is she?
Yeah, so Thompson's a military lifer, basically. He's into his middle 40s. He served in all these theaters. He was a brigadier. He had done pretty well for himself. He really performed well at Versailles and made a name for himself. But he had met, when he was stationed in Bucharest in Romania in World War I, he was the military attaché there. And he met this sort of fairy tale princess named Marta Bibesco. And she really was a fairy tale princess. I mean, she was, she was immensely wealthy. She was married to a prince. She had two, not one, but two palaces. In addition to that, she was the toast of literary Paris in, let's say, 1908, 1909, she was the toast of literary Paris. And I mean that just as it sounds. She had written a couple of books that were bestsellers, that were reviewed, that were widely admired. I mean, Marcel Proust wrote her poems. André Gide was a friend. I mean, this was the gang that she was rolling with. So we have this fairy tale princess who's immensely wealthy and has palaces in Bucharest, in Romania, and is the toast of literary Paris. And Thompson, who has, he's a very cultivated guy. He speaks five languages, and he's not just a soldier of empire. He's much more sort of, he's not sort of just some, soldier guy. He is unusual in the variety of his interests. So he falls in love with him to some extent for the rest of his life, or the rest of his life becomes the tale of how he's trying to impress Martha. And of course, as a military lifer, the years after he meets her, she's having affairs with, the editor of the largest French daily and the most eligible bachelor in France and the king of, Germany and princess. This is who she's interested in. And so the book becomes, so as Thompson's ambition sort of vaults forward, it's Martha is very much wrapped up in this right to the end. It's kind of a great love story behind the tale of doomed ambition.
I called him Thomas. I don't know why I called him Thomas.
Thompson. Oh, yeah, close enough.
Yeah, near
Lord Thompson of Cardington. This is really interesting. So you can you get to be a lord, right? If you're Kitchener, you can choose to be Kitchener of Khartoum. Yeah, all right. That's pretty good. Yeah,
It's half the fun of getting the gig. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So Lord Christopher Birdwood. So Christopher Birdwood Thompson is made a lord by Ramsay MacDonald, and I think it was in order that he be able to be in the House of Lords. I guess that's the rule. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he he chose this gritty, well, so we have Bedford right about an hour north of London, and then this kind of gritty industrial suburb just south of Bedford, you know, called Cardington, which is the center of the British airship universe. And he chose to be lord of a gritty little industrial suburb of Bedford. Kind of interesting.
Let's get on to the Imperial Airship Scheme, because that's why he chooses Cardington. Because Cardington Sheds, which is still there, they're making an airship in there at the moment. Yeah, it's
that was where Warner Brothers owns them, and Batman was filmed there.
Yep, and
I was in one of the walking around, and some of the set stuff is still stacked back there. Anyway, surreal.
It's fab. Again, different podcast.
Batman connection.
We could digress beautifully there. The Imperial Airship Scheme is the thing that Thompson nails his colours to, and his whole political career is around this. What was it? Because this is when we think of, you know, aircraft being produced today, yes, we think of subsidies and the like. But in this case, this was an entire government, which, let's be fair, was broke, throwing whatever treasure they had behind this scheme of building not one, but two of the most supposedly advanced airships the world had ever seen.
Yes, in a way that was in their intention to change the world. So to understand the Imperial Airship Scheme, you have to understand what the world looks like to Great Britain as we come out of World War One. As I said, it's very interesting because even though Great Britain had taken a major hit to its power, when coming out of the war, its naval power supremacy was not unquestioned anymore. It was governed by a formula that said how many ships you can build. And there were cracks in the empire, you could just see them adding up, the Boer War, and then there was the Irish Rebellion and then the rebellion in Iraq and of course what was happening in India. India was seething with discontent. But coming out of World War One, still, Britain had the largest empire in the history of the world. They had taken a lot of the properties of the old Ottoman Empire, some from Germany. They had, the famous British color, the British maps with the red color. I mean, you could see it connecting up all around the world. A quarter of the world's population was within, one way or the other, between commonwealths and dominions and colonies and everything else, the British Empire. And so this was the reality. And so men of empire who still believed in empire began to dream of some sort of new way to think about their empire. And what ended up happening was started, I think the first reference to an Imperial Airship Scheme was 1922, but by 1924, when Christopher Birdwood Thompson becomes the Secretary of State for Air, which is over all military and civil aviation, by this point, it has evolved. And here's the idea. Here's what the Imperial Airship Scheme was. It was an attempt to link the far-flung, increasingly far-flung pieces of the British Empire together through this medium of the air. At that point in history, it was not settled yet whether airplanes or airships were going to be the long-range travel. Airplanes have long-range means of travel. Airplanes had real trouble on long trips. I mean, a trip to India was 12 bone rattling days and 26 stops. I mean, through the heats of Iraq. And I mean, it was not a lot of fun. So people thought, Lindbergh notwithstanding, that the airships could possibly be the long range travel. Anyway, this idea, the Imperial Scheme, was to populate the world with British airships that were going to fly from, Sydney to London in South Africa to London in Egypt to, from London to New York or Toronto and back. There was going to be this just connecting up the pieces of the British Empire. And why was this significant? Well, the largest significance, I think, could be understood by anybody, which is that, so at this point, it took, for the Premier of Australia, of British Dominion, to get from Sydney to London, a month, That was a month. Airship could do it in 11 days. From London to Karachi, almost 12 days. Airship could do it in 4 days. I mean, you're talking 2.5 days across the Atlantic. It's not because airships were so fast. It was because they didn't need to land. So they fly at 60 or 70 miles an hour, 24 hours. And so if you're going from London to Karachi, you stopped once in Ismailia, Egypt, and one refueling, and you could make it, and you could make it very, very quickly. And this completely changed in the minds of the people who invented the airship scheme, Lord Thompson chief among them. This changed the whole world, right? Space and time, the whole, everything gets redefined if you're, and the empire becomes much, much closer together, you know, 11 days versus a month to Australia, for example. And so this was the idea. But beyond that, though, it was so you're going to have these airships flying back and forth, you know, passing each other on the routes of empire. But more or as important as that, though, the technology that was going to dominate this new version of long range travel was going to be British. And that is what R101, the hero airship of my story, was. R101 was, and its sister ship R100, were Christopher Birdwood Thompson's attempt to use this new, to improve the old German technology with the British technology and demonstrate that you could fly these things back and forth safely from places like India, you know, which was still, you know, within the British Empire and ruled by the British and had 20 million people in it. This was going to change the world. They thought they were going to change the world.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we are with the Pima Air and Space Museum's Learjet Model 23. The Model 23 was Learjet's first small business jet. This one was owned by the Timken family of Ohio, the Timken ball bearings. They were a company that made well-known ball bearings for all different types of machinery. Louise Timken was the matriarch of the family, and she was the first woman to get a jet pilot's license here in the United States for the Learjet. She had gotten a license for a smaller, like four-seat jet beforehand. The zebra skin inside on the seats was from a zebra that she shot in safari back in the day. They flew this aircraft for many years before, after they had moved out and retired out here to Arizona. They finally at one point stopped flying the airplane and they donated it here to the Pima Air and Space Museum. Also on display in our Women in Flight exhibit is a red visor and red shoes that she always wore when she was flying this airplane. Over the years, Louise Timken, you know, it's gotten many awards for just, you know, being who she was, you know, in Ohio and here in Arizona.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And now, back to the show. it's this weird time, that sort of middle 20s, when this is all coming up, because you've got these two technologies that are slightly diverging. And on one hand, you've got still airplanes, which are essentially papery things tied up with string. And you've got these big, massive, potentially luxurious things. And like you said, it's quite a bone-rattling trip. So that's why they plumb for airships as opposed to what we would then see explode 10 years later with commercial air travel in a small form. But the government decides to go two ways, don't they? And this is where I think it's interesting, because, you know, Thompson's politics is very much of the left, isn't it? So they want an airship of government and of the people, and yep. one of commerce. And that's the sort of difference between 100 and 101, isn't it? It's a weird political schism almost to get these things going, which is how Vickers enters the story as well.
Right. And when you think of the typical way that aircraft or airships would have been done, they were, you know, largely companies like Vickers built them, you know, sort of under contract one way or the other. That's how these things got built, and that's how wars got won. But so enter the Britain's first Labour government in 1924, Ramsay MacDonald, his great Secretary of State for Air, Christopher Birdwood Thompson. What they're going to do, they decide, they're going to, you know, for the first time, the British government's going to build, well, R101. They're going to build two ships, actually, but the first one and the main one, and the one that's going to get all the technology and all the money, and that has what I don't know what you call it. I guess cost plus is what I would call it. It's whatever you need. Whatever you need was R101, and they indeed loaded this thing with all sorts of technology. They took diesels up into the air for the first time, and material science and pumping science and all sorts of things. So R101 was going to be the socialist airship run by the government, which would turn out to be a very good example of why governments have trouble building things. But the other airship was the more traditional, you know, the way you would normally. They gave Vickers a contract and they said, here's a couple million bucks, build it for that. Use the old Zeppelin model. We don't want a lot of innovation. We just want the thing to work. You go do that. And meanwhile, over here, the socialist airship is going to be the visionary, idealistic airship. It's just going to be filled with all kinds of wild new technologies. And this is, as we go along, these sort of two ships get built, and they indeed turn out the way they were meant to be. And the capital airship is a better airship, but and it doesn't crash, and the government, the socialist airship, does crash.
I'm sure someone will pull a metaphor out of that, but we're not going to do that either. because it's this fascinating sort of competition of almost government excess going on, isn't it? Because on one side, you've got a very interesting group of designers whose names most people will know, but probably not for airships, in Barnes Wallis and his calculator, who's Neville Shute, who go away from making calculations and writing some fabulous stories. It's weird that a lot of what we have is their, you know, the guys who survive are the guys that tell the story, isn't it? And their input from what they were doing and what they perceived was happening down at Cardington, because they're up in the northwest, aren't they? So they're a ways away from what's going on at Cardington.
Right. It's what part of the story becomes this competition between the R100 and the R101. And it is interesting. Thompson should never have done that. He split. I mean, there were the surviving. There was a terrible British air crash in 1921 where basically most of the airship establishment had gone down with it. So there were very few people.
Should have been a clue, really, shouldn't it?
Should have been a clue. Yeah. But so there weren't very many British airship designers out there with any experience at all. And by splitting all the talent, if you will, between the R100 and the R101, you know, they in effect, I think, doomed R101. So the person with by far the most skill and talent, and who is in fact a legendary engineer, a British engineer, Barnes Wallis, ends up with, and his assistant Neville Shute, end up on the R100. And They have major grudges against the R100. There's no cooperation at all. Nobody returns phone calls, so to speak. They don't. It becomes a real problem. And I'd say the first of many, many problems that beset this airship as they try to make it. I mean, there were a lot of problems in the building of it and in the trials of it. But it started with, the man who should have been running that project was Barnes Wallace. And there should have only been one airship.
I'm sure Barnes Wallace would have agreed with it.
And Neville Shute, his assistant, you know, this is, there are all little funny little corners of the story, like Martha Vivesco, but Neville Shute, his name was Neville Shute Norway, and he wrote under Neville Shute. And one of the most prominent British writers of the mid-century. I mean, he was so prominent that I, little American guy, in eighth grade, I read this book called On the Beach. I don't know who put it in my hands. It changed my life. It was about nuclear war. And there's a great scene at the end of the book, but eventually the movie with Gregory Peck, where I think the world has just been bombed, and he's on the bridge of the boat going out of Sydney Harbor, I think it is, or somewhere. And like, they're the last people on Earth. Everybody else is dead or about to die, or the radiation has been released. I'm just thinking, wow. Anyway, so this is sort of meaningful to me that he was one of the airship designers who, you know, did survive and did comment on R101.
Let's focus on 101. As much as I'd love to talk about Neville Shute and, you know, his books, my grandmother foisted his books on me at a young age and loved them all. But let's, again, another, this, seriously, we could digress beautifully. Batman, Neville Shute, we'd be away. R101 in itself becomes very quickly, I hate to use the term over-engineered because it crashes, so clearly it wasn't, but it, to make it work, they keep having to try new things, but then also strip stuff out of it to make it work. Because the calculations to make an airship fly are very, very finite. It's hydrogen plus weight, and then that gives you your altitudes and things. So you describe it a lot better than I just did in your book. But to make R101 work, they have to make some remarkable compromises, especially considering what they're making it out of.
There, it's a technological moonshot. I mean, from the point of view of 1927, 1928, 1929, 1930. I mean, it was, as you were saying, the question of being over-engineers. Well, one of the things they did to over-engineer it, I think, was one of the causes of the crash, which is they decided they were, before R101, all the engines that, you know, so on let's take a ship like R101, okay, it's 777 feet long, larger by volume than the Titanic, the largest thing that has ever flown in history of the world. And it's going up there and it's got five engines on it. And so the engines normally would be gasoline engines of one type or another. But because this ship was flying over the tropics, or, you know, the thought was that gas fumes were flammable, and therefore you didn't want something flammable sitting right beneath. I mean, these engines are slung beneath the envelope of the airship. You didn't want something like that there because, you know, you've got 5.5 million cubic feet of hydrogen sitting just above you. In fact, this was a false fear. I mean, it was an unfounded, not a false fear. It was an unfounded fear. But to address this and to make, you know, this, there was a Titanic-like attempt to make this airship, the equivalent of unsinkable, as Thompson said, as safe as a house, but for the millionth chance. I mean, something that just couldn't crash. They really thought that they were doing this. And one of the ways they were doing this was they took diesels from locomotives and they put them up into the air, into these engine nacelles that would drive the engines of R101. Now, and the reason was because the heavy oil or diesel didn't have had a very, I guess we would call a high flash point, right? You couldn't set it on fire. You could put a match to it and it would burn. So this was the idea. The problem was, but you take these locomotive diesels, these Beardmore Tornado 650 horsepower diesel, and you hoist them up into the air, into a lighter than air ship, by the way, which everything has been stripped out of. And it's like double the weight of the gas engine, which then creates all of these problems. And they were the principal problem when the thing first flew. They realized, oh my God, it's too heavy. It will never go anywhere. Mainly because of these engines that they decided they were going to put up there. All sorts of technology went into this and all sorts of engineering. And it was a mistake. It was over-engineered, caused the airship to be too heavy, and necessitated all sorts of re-engineering, which then created their own problems. But there were so many engineering problems on this thing. It's so many organizational screw-ups, it's hard to know where to start.
It's page after page of, you know, as a business analyst, it's like case study after case study of how not to run a project. And it's I love your descriptions of how the plush lounges and rooms on board are essentially veneered balsa wood because they can't have mahogany and things on it because it's too heavy. They're having to cut right back to the lightest possible woods they can and then painting them. It's just this remarkable stripping back of things and to what would be expected of the people that would be traveling upon it.
Yeah, it was. So they put everything on the ship. That was the idea. Everything conceivable thing. So somebody at this wonderful dirigible magazine, you know, put together a diagram with all the arrows pointing to all the wild new technologies that they put in and things that had never been done before. So they had this, you know, elaborate dining hall, you know, that looks is meant to look kind of like a Pullman car or like an admiral's quarters in a steamship. In fact, it's all balsa wood and linen. It's nothing. I mean, in ultra light aluminum. They have a lounge. They have a promenade. You know, with a big window, a big Celan window that you can look at. That they have a smoking lounge in a ship filled with 5.5 million cubic feet of hydrogen gas. It just goes on and on and on. And all this was, you know, engineered. I mean, they wanted to make this the most luxurious thing that had ever flown, which it clearly was. At that point, nothing was even close to it. It was still not as luxurious as you know, like a Cunard ocean liner. Mm. Because you just couldn't, you know, as you say, hoist mahogany up there. But all of these things, all of these technologies were put in. I mean, the gas bags on this thing were 10 stories high. Imagine a cheese wheel 10 stories high that is made out of cattle intestines that holds 550,000 cubic feet of hydrogen. And these things were held in place inside this 777-foot-long airship by these incredibly innovative parachute harnesses that no one had ever done before. Again, engineered to the max. As it turns out, they failed to keep the bags from grating against the girders and getting holes in them, lots of thousands of them, which then leaked hydrogen. And anyway, it seems like I'm singling out Great Britain here for technological flaws. Airships were deeply, deeply flawed things from the very beginning. And hydrogen was just one of them, enormously vulnerable to wind, weather of any kind. They were a bad idea. And it took 40 years for people to realize they were a bad idea. And that was that. But the Germans were the ones who invented it. And the Americans absolutely got on board. And they all pretty much lost all their airships to crashes. So there was the Americans were very much in the technological race in the 20s. They were building helium-filled airships, which everybody thought, hey, if helium, that what could possibly go wrong, right? Well, look at a terrible record of crashes, three really bad ones that were entirely built and engineered by the Americans. So everybody had, you know, and as far as hydrogen fireballs go, there were 75 of them. I mean, you think of the Hindenburg as, wow, well, that's wild. That's crazy. That's incredible. No, it happened all the time. And the only reason you and I don't know about that is because there wasn't that 30 seconds of film that changed the world. Everybody in every movie theater in the world saw the Hindenburg go up in flames in 1937, which, by the way, was 7 years after the R-101 went up in a similar hydrogen fireball.
It's It's wonderful madness. It's a line I use quite a bit when talking about marvels of the air that are strange. You know, it's the way you capture the sort of almost internal politicking of, we need to make all these changes, but we can't tell anyone we're making these changes because we've got to make the trip to Karachi. It's weird. The book is fantastic. It's imperial politics, high engineering, and you're just sitting there going, "Don't stop, everybody." You know?
It's a book. It's a book. You know, at some point, this happens to me when I'm writing. Is, you know, I think I'm writing about something. In this case, the crash of an airship and this man's dream of the imperial scheme, of which it is the poster ship, for which it is the poster ship. But I mean, sometimes in the middle of things, and it happened here, I realized that I'm writing about an airship crash, but what I'm really writing about is human folly. And it's widely shared. I say this was a flawed idea. You know, and if you go back, and it's a wonderful madness. I love the term. It's like if you look in the aughts or the teens or something, you had these early years of both airships and aircraft. And they're crashing all the time. Both of them are. And I think, I'm not getting on that thing. I mean, my personal feeling is, no, you go ahead and fly the experimental prototype biplane, or the Hercules trimotor, to see if it works. Yeah, I'll wait here, okay? And the same thing with airships. There's a time when the only way technology progresses is through madness. Who's going to get on that thing? I mean, R101 is an experimental prototype, and you don't put a cabinet secretary and the Britain's director of civil aviation up in an experimental prototype. It's like, it's fine if Chuck Yeager flies the X-1 and tries to break the sound barrier, and it's expected that he may die, and that's the ground rule, right? But you don't put the Secretary of Defense up in the rear seat when Chuck goes up. Which is what they did in R101. They should not have put those people in. At one point, Thompson was so confident he wanted to put 100 MPs up at once, a substantial chunk of the people governing Great Britain, into this thing. Anyway, I'm going on.
I'm pretty sure there's 100 MPs we could put on it today and everyone would be quite happy.
Actually, it might be a good thing.
That period of time is just utterly fascinating because, you know, you've got this sort of explosion of aviation. You've got air races, flying circuses. You've got all these things where it's becoming more normal, and these grand steps as well. And this, you know, even of its time, it must have felt slightly out of time that there was this grand thing happening. And, you know, of course, when it finally comes in, it's in the middle of the post-crash times. We're not going to talk about the crash and things. People, you need to buy the book because Sam's done a great job. But now that it's been out for a while, I grabbed my copy in New York in May, so I've read it. This is going to go out for the UK release as well. It's been out for a while. How do you feel about it? I guess. Oh goodness, it's been out for about 4 or 5 months now.
May 2nd was the yeah.
So just shout out to 192 Books in New York, which is my new favorite bookshop. It was fantastic.
Well, it's been selling well, and it's been reviewed very well. And, you know, over here, you get a spectacular New York Times review, which I got. You know, it's that's very good. In the old days, that used to be the only, you know, didn't matter what else you did, you know. And these days, you have to link up with the online world and the world that isn't just a publicist who's trying to get your story in the Chicago Tribune, which was the old way. That isn't the new way. But I think it's been, you know, my sense is that it's people are interested in it and people are talking about it. So that's good. Beyond that, I can't control what happens.
And you end up talking to random guys on a podcast that...
That's right. People in some foreign country that I don't even know where the foreign country is.
Someone in a foreign country who's actually thinking about your weather sounding quite nice. Because what is it? About 120 in Texas at the moment? Or?
Yeah. So to put it in your terms, today it's hitting 42.2.
Ooh.
Okay. So, and yesterday was 42.2. and tomorrow will be 42, and the next day will be 42, and the next day, and going out as far as we can see. So this is not normal. And please, some dreary, wet British weather, please, please send it to Texas.
I can hear listeners, because this is going to be going out in October. There's going to be some listeners here in the UK just shouting at you now. But that sounds tough.
It's pretty tough. But speaking of the UK, I mean, I was, you know, part of the fun of this book was I started it right when COVID started. So, you know, I use libraries, museums and collections and things like that. And, you know, they're all closed to me globally, everything, every single library, museum, whatever. And so I had to do all these workarounds, and the British Airship community, which is small and intense and wonderful, they helped me out. But I eventually got to I stayed in Richmond for 3 weeks, last year, had a wonderful time. And you know, going to the United Kingdom archives, the RAF Museum, Brooklyn's, the private archives here, and I just had a great time. It was and the Cardington Sheds, you know. It was just a great component, and I had spectacular spring weather for the whole 3 weeks.
I think you should just come over more if you're going to bring good weather. So it can't be a British podcast unless there's at least 5 minutes chatting about weather. I think that's the rule. But Sam, the book is fantastic. Thank you so much for spending the last little while chatting about it. And as usual, links to getting it are all in the description, and everybody should buy it because it's really good fun.
Great. It's been great talking to you, Matt.
I can't thank Sam enough for joining us here on the Damcasters. I love the book. I grabbed my copy back in May at the fabulous 101 Books in New York, read it in a couple of sittings, and I'm delighted to say that it's out now in the UK, so you can grab it at all good and evil bookshops, including, not evil, but supporting the pod bookshop of our very own Damcasters bookshop on bookshop.org. Link is in the description below. 10% goes to support the pod, all that usual stuff. You may have heard my reticence about R101, but I think where we are now with airships and lighter than air vehicles is in an interesting place, especially with Airlander, which hybrid air vehicles are building up at Cardington right now. So watch that space on this. As always, thank you for your support of the pod. Tell your friends, pop some stars into the algorithm, like the videos, do all that sort of thing. We're going to have some fun stuff coming up, especially some news about the Pima Air and Space Museum and what's going on there. They've been incredibly generous supporters of the pod, so we're going to see what's going on out there. If you want to become a Damcasteer, you can join us over on Patreon from just £3 a month. On that, you'll get all of these episodes early, different intros, outros, basically me rambling a little bit more, but there's going to be gift packs. You get a hand-signed card from me, really. If you can decipher it, good on you. But there'll be like bookmarks and stickers and stuff and some other fun things coming along that they're going to hear about first over there. So, like I said, check that out. Link in the description below. Do give Sam a follow. All his socials are in the description as well. And of course, we're now on Blue Sky, which is great because it's like Twitter, but without the chaos. Give it time. We shall see. All the links to our socials are on our link tree. Thank you so much for your support. This has been great fun over the last year we've been doing this now. And I can't thank you enough. I've already said that. So we're going to wrap it up. Until next time, do take care of yourselves. Bye-bye. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Boney Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcast and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.